This is Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Rudeness and what to do about it.
So I call the destruction of Al Gore in 2000 Snark's greatest victory and Snark's greatest triumph because, after all, it did have enormous effect.
That's David Denby. We talked to him about his book, Snark. It's mean, it's personal, and it's ruining our conversation.
Civility, good manners, and politeness are not trivial because they do the everyday busy work of goodness.
And that's P.M. Forney. We talked to him in the second half of the show about what to do when people are rude. But first, we turn our attention to rudeness in the media, specifically to snark, that malicious snideness that masquerades as superiority but is a refuge of small minds. It's on TV, the radio, in the columns of newspapers, but most of all on the Internet, where people can get away with the most outrageous snarkiness behind the mask of anonymity. Film critic David Denby says snark is ruining our discourse in the media. And he says it's lazy, using media memes that are just lying around in the cultural landscape to mount personal attacks that don't deal with the content of what they're attacking. In his book, Snark, Denby says snarkers think they're practicing the high art of satire, but they're not.
Snark is a particular kind of personal insult that's a lot of in our public discourse and journalism. It's directed at individuals, and it's nasty, abusive, teasing, undermining, rug-pulling insult that often depends on, for the person who's hearing it, some knowing reference that pins the victim by associating him with some group or other that the list dislikes. In other words, it's insult that's lazy, that doesn't create a fresh image or a fresh metaphor. If you create a fresh image, I don't care how nasty you are. This is not some crusade against nastiness. Obviously, satire is a healthy part of democracy, and I'm all for it. And this book is full of examples of stuff that I love, going back to the Greeks and the Romans and Swift and Pope, and I love John Stewart and Stephen Colbert and Tina Fey. These are all my heroes. But they're creating wit. They're not just lazily pulling something that's sitting around making a reference that people will understand. I mean, what Rush Limbaugh does is snark all the time. I didn't bother with him or with Ann Coulter, that sort of gangling, gurgling, reactionary buffoon.
Let's not be snarky now.
Is that snark? I think so. Because everyone else has been attacking them, and I thought their ideology is in shreds, and they're losing the ideological wars, and they're growing more and more desperate and saying more and more foolish things to hold on to their audience.
Well, you talk about high snark and low snark. I mean, some snark isn't maybe necessarily lazy, except perhaps intellectually. But I found especially interesting your link between snark and resentment.
Yeah. Look, the Internet is an amazing event in the history of democracy. I don't think anyone disagrees with that, that this is the most remarkable event since universal suffrage. The notion that anyone can address a large audience, addressing a large audience is no longer an activity that's dominated by the owners of the presses and their hirelings like myself, professional writers, but that anyone can do that is astounding and wonderful. But along with de Tocqueville said, in the wake of a democratic revolution, you have this outburst of creativity and fellow feeling and sharing. But you also have an explosion of anger, pent-up resentment, bile that gets released. And you see a lot of that in the anonymous web contributions that people make, or the way they tag into conversational threads following some article. So there's a lot of anger out there, and it's not really, I mean, I was functioning as a critic of style, the way I usually function as a critic of movies, wanted to isolate this one strain of ill humor. But it's really up to a social psychologist to say why there's so much of it. And it scares me because I think we might not have as free an internet always as we have now. There are legal heavyweights, including Cass Sunstein, who's in the Obama administration, who are seriously concerned by how much insult, gossip, possibly slanderous gossip is out there about many of us, and are wondering whether do we really want a completely, you know, open internet forever and ever if there are no protections of our privacy.
But as you point out, this technology may be abetting something that already really has existed for many centuries, millennia, in fact. I'd like to get back to the snark, because I'd like to kind of tease out what are some of the things that are common to snark throughout the millennia, and then what are some things that are different about our time. So take us back in time for a minute. Take us back all the way to the Athenians.
Well, let's distinguish the word from the act. The word is new, relatively new. I mean, Lewis Carroll, who wrote Alice in Wonderland and Through the Looking Glass, essentially made it up in 1876 in a nonsense poem called The Hunting of the Snark. The snark was a mythical beast, and all of Victorian society hunts it. And you never find out what the snark is exactly. By degrees, the meaning of the word by about 1905 or so had shifted to something closer to what we mean now. That is, to rag at someone, to get at someone, to try to undermine someone. The act, of course, is eternal. And as I said before, part of human nature. But historically, in trying to create a kind of myth of origins, I located, after reading some scholarly work on the Greeks, in the Athenian drinking clubs, aristocrats gathered to drink in ancient Athens, hardly a surprise. Maybe 800-900 BC, around the time of Homer even, you know, 400 years or so before the great period of Athens with the playwrights and philosophers. And men would gather under a tent or around a fire or at someone's house and tell stories and sing songs. And maybe at one of these jolly gatherings, someone had the bright idea of taking the persona of a lowborn Athenian and attacking someone in the room, and attacking particularly his sexual behavior and his appetite of behavior, feasting, eating, making love, so on. In other words, it was within a club, and you were privileged to allow to hear those personal attacks, those knowing references to someone. Then it burst into the public arena a few hundred years later, in a poetic form that was very strict in its rules. In other words, you could attack your leaders publicly as long as you obeyed certain rules of composition. It was a formal genre of poetry, like Homer's heroic verse. This was a kind of low verse, but still disciplined by form. And it continues on into Roman oratory, where there were certain areas of very personal vulnerability in your opponent. You know, it was permissible to attack in the Roman Senate and so on. In Cicero's handbooks, he sets out, you know, certain ways you can denigrate people. And so
using, for example, you say, you suck was a classic form of invective.
Yes, not exactly as a metaphor, but literally. Cicero made fun of Mark Antony's sex life. So it was there, but again, it obeyed certain formal rules of oratory. I mean, it wasn't just a casual sarcasm. So I think, you know, you can trace it that way. And I sort of leap around, and I try to make a kind of historical scheme of table of values with satire, which is a much more elaborate form. Satire is really a kind of insult that attacks manners and morals and so on, but with the implication of a better world, of a corrective, of a redemption. I mean, Swift being the greatest in the early 18th century. Anyway, satire on the top, the kind of invective that I've been describing with its formal rules, somewhere in the middle, and the modern snark, which doesn't obey rules and is just, as I say, parasitic and lazy, on the bottom.
However, an interesting point you make here, and I think that is a thread that runs through, is that somehow snark is it's a refuge of either a dispossessed elite or elite wannabes, people who haven't quite made it and are trying to social climb.
Yeah, right. It can work either way. People who are within power and afraid of losing it, a kind of natural reactionary attempt to hold on to social power or property or whatever is one form, one time when it occurs, or the reverse, just as you say, when the outsiders are banging on the gates. I mean, that's certainly that latter condition is what you have now with all the kids on the internet attacking the mainstream media constantly. Let us in. The comedy of that situation is that people who write, say, for gossip sites on the internet and attack the mainstream media take the mainstream media jobs as soon as they can get them.
Yeah.
Because they pay so much better. So,
they pay, period.
Yeah, they pay, exactly, period. Because it's very hard to live in New York, Los Angeles, or Washington, which is where most of this stuff originates. It's not a Midwestern phenomenon or a New England phenomenon, that's for sure. It's very hard to live in those big cities, on a few thousand dollars a year. And that brings up a whole other issue, that why is there so much of it? Putting it plainly, there's a kind of panic going on. Yeah, certainly in print journalism, because a lot of us are afraid that our beloved publications will sink into the web, into an electronic presence only. For instance, Newsweek, I keep hearing that about it. And newspapers, of course, are beginning to collapse because they've lost so much advertising. We're afraid that these publications will have much less authority once they join the web than they do as hard copy. And I think that there's a tendency to snark by establishment journalists in order to hold on to what they see as a disappearing young audience.
Well, you, David Denby, in your book, Snark, you say that Snark is investigative reporting's, quote, bastard weak-limbed child. Is this what you're talking about?
Well, yes, investigative reporting is one of the things that I'm afraid will disappear if newspapers have an electronic presence only, because it takes so much money and resources and time and patience to do a good investigative piece. It may take 6 or 8 weeks. Just pursuing a local story about corruption in City Hall, say, or awarding of contracts, the most common kind of corruption, and it's absolutely necessary that newspapers do this. Someone's got to keep the scoundrels, honest, or at least to push them towards honesty. And a lot of us are afraid that if newspapers have an electronic presence only and ads that they can sell for much less money than their current hard copy ads, that's one thing that will disappear. Snark would be simply insults replacing real hard work. Investigative reporting is hard. You've got to make hundreds of phone calls. You've got to go to the library and look up records or use the Internet extensively. Anyone who's ever done it will tell you, how difficult it is. I'm just not sure it's going to survive if everything goes electronic, and that is a terrible blow to a democracy.
Ironically, it's almost the kind of corollary to reality TV, which replaced so much of TV content. This is hardly reality that we're really seeing on reality TV, and the point of reality TV is to put people down.
A lot of it, that's the entertainment value of it, yeah. You're absolutely right. And I just stuck to journalism. I didn't even go into reality TV, but you're right. What the draw is the put down, like Simon Cowell on American Idol telling someone, well, you're lucky if you get to be a lounge act on a cruise liner. But I would say in defense of that anyone who goes on American Idol knows what the stakes are, right? And is setting himself up for being put down. It's the anonymous insult at folk who, haven't done anything. I think it's beginning to be troublesome. For instance, on campus, the worst offender, a site called Juicy Campus, just closed down. But for the last few years, the following scenario takes place over and over again. A guy sleeps with a girl and then posts anonymously very intimate stuff about her, very nasty, funny, always written in snarky terms for other people to read, either on campus, his own campus, or all over the country, all over the world. The victim is named. The person who writes the stuff is not named. He's hiding behind a handle. And that stuff is there forever. When you're 20 and you've, gone through a sloshed weekend, let's say, not unknown, among 20-year-olds, you could laugh all this off, but, 7 or 8 years later, you're going to go for a job somewhere, serious job, and it'll Google up.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with New Yorker film critic David Denby. You know, in your book, Snark, you really dissect the anatomy of this beast. I think it's a very interesting section. I mean, I'd like to get a little into this anatomy. First of all, you put out what you call the whatever principle. Tell us what that is.
Oh, meaning that attack randomly. Yes, there's a section of the book which I engage in a kind of mock handbook for prospective snarkers. I mean, I meant it ironically or satirically, of course. Like the old Strunken White guidebook to good style, this is a guidebook to terrible style. And yes, one of the principles was just attack randomly whenever you can, whether the person deserves it or not. And I gave some examples. Some other principles are ignore all the common processes of journalism, the responsibilities of journalism, like making telephone calls to check facts or, you know, getting multiple sources. Just print any rumor that you hear. The websites owned by Nick Denton, like Gawker and so on, have been doing this for years. Wonkette used to be his, and he sold it off. That's the political site in Washington.
And Wonkette, you give the example in the whatever principle of her, you know, completely off-the-wall attack on Chelsea Clinton when she was just a child.
Yeah, I mean, the attacking Chelsea seems to have been a pastime for years. I mean, no less than John McCain did it famously a decade ago when she was a teenager. Yeah, that's just sort of random malice, but never checking anything. And this is now a little parochial within the media world, but anyone who has any power, of course, has enemies. Someone has been passed over for a job, that kind of thing. So if someone has a grudge and they phone it in, it can wind up in one of these gossip sites, a grudge against the boss or something, and it's never checked. They don't make phone calls. It's just out there. And in a peculiar way, it's naive because the people who write it don't realize that they're being used by someone who has a grudge to work off. I met this woman in Washington who said, what's the big deal about this? If someone anonymously attacks me on the web, I'll just attack back. I mean, I may not know who it is. I'll just attack whoever wrote that and use that handle. And I thought to myself, in fact, I said to her, great, you know, that's just great. You can have a social model now in which everyone attacks everyone, and you can't trust any of it. You don't know what's true and what isn't true, what's been checked, and what, you know, what's just mere assertion lounging around out there. That's what has the legal scholars worry, that there's no safety of surrounding our reputations anymore.
And it's not just, of course, private individuals and or public individuals for that matter. I mean, for example, you talk about how what a profound impact it can have on the life of a nation. I mean, let's take, for example, the case of Al Gore. When he ran for president of the United States, you know, he was widely ridiculed for saying that he invented the internet, something he actually never said.
Right.
And then you take up Maureen Dowd at the New York Times. Talk a little bit about your critique of Maureen Dowd, and then go into what the impact was on the life of our nation.
Well, the most talented writer of Snark that I can think of is Maureen Dowd of the New York Times, a very popular political columnist, and I don't want to be misunderstood, and I lean over backward, I think, to be fair to her. I think she's extremely intelligent and can be extremely funny. But what's missing in Maureen Dowd is any political idea at all, any notion of what the whole point of politics or government is. She ruthlessly mocks anyone who runs for office, and she did it again with Hillary and Barack last spring, and got them both wrong. She often gets things wrong because she only deals with the manner, the surface, never with the ideas, the substance. She has no interest in policy, which she seems to think is for drips. So, yes, back there in 2000, look, Al Gore, as we all know, it stiffens up in public. Everyone who knows him says he's very warm in person, and I've seen him talk about environmental hazards and policies, and he's terrific when he talks about that. But when he talks about public policy or when he's other public policy, when he's running for office, as in 2000, he seems like your school principal. And that's his fault, of course, not Maureen Dowd's fault. But she and all the many imitators were ruthless in making fun of his stiff manner rather than dealing with his ideas. So I call the destruction of Al Gore in 2000 Snark's greatest victory and Snark's greatest triumph, because after all it did have enormous effect with a failed presidency. So, you know, there is that destructive element that can reach international politics.
In fact, I'd love you to read a section from your book. Do you happen to have it there?
Hold on, let me get it. Yes.
Okay. This again is about Dowd, only now we've moved ahead in time. She's realized that she blew it about Bush, and she's critiquing him. So go to page 112.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. Dowd did everything she could to destroy Al Gore. She may not even have disagreed with his policies, but she never dealt with his policies. She dealt with his appearance, his manner, and so on. And then Bush becomes president, and she's appalled by Bush and by Cheney and by Rumsfeld, and she makes remorseless fun of them and sometimes exposes their dishonesties in ways that I think were correct and true. But the weakness of Snark as a rhetorical mode couldn't have been clearer to me than in her performance. And I've written, the president may have appeared in Dowd's Freudian family drama as a petulant child trying to outdo his father, but he was, in fact, a far more stubborn and cunning man than she gave him credit for. As the Bush administration went on, the insufficiencies of Snark became mortifyingly obvious. Did it ever occur to Dowd that her chummy, high schoolish, I can see your undies routine might be bizarrely beside the point? Given the enormity of the war in Iraq and the lies used to sustain it, which she exposed as vigorously as anyone else, did she ever wonder whether puns and sarcasm were adequate to the task? In the end, the Bush administration embarrassed Dowd's powers of ridicule. Not that Bush was anything like Hitler, but Dowd was very much like Ernst Lubitsch, the director of To Be or Not to Be, or Charles Chaplin, the director and performer of The Great Dictator, and other people around 1940 who thought that laughing at a tyrant might be the way to humble him. Catching the president in contradictions and hypocrisies, bouncing ping-pong balls off the square forehead of Rummy, or teasing the lugubrious Cheney as vice and babysitter, none of this came close to an adequate critique of power. Dowd's ridicule didn't help us keep our sanity in hard times, as the movie and radio wisecracks did during the Depression, that contributed to the impotent nihilism of the period. Dangerous lies and irresponsible snark were part of the same despairing mood. No journalist could have changed the course of the Bush administration, but Dowd's scattershots, funny as some of them were, never even amounted to a coherent narrative of what was going on.
Yeah, that's really a wonderful passage, and I think it encapsulates, as you say, the nihilism, the critique of Snark as nihilism, and how that kind of nihilism has profoundly contaminated our public discourse. What I found interesting about Dowd is that she actually gave up Snark in a very famous, unfortunate column of hers, and that was during the Mission Accomplished speech. I actually looked it up, and I have it here. You know, she talks about Bush coming in on the helicopter onto the flight deck, and she writes, "Outbounded the cocky, rule-breaking daredevil flyboy, a man navigating the highway to the danger zone, out along the edges where he was born to be. The further on the edge, the hotter the intensity."
Oh, yeah, great.
How do you explain this?
Well, she got turned on, like a lot of people, I guess, by Bush's, you know, flight costume and his whole manner on board the deck. It looks pretty sad now.
It certainly does.
Yeah. I mean, she's having trouble at the moment finding her tone because she can't find anything in Obama to make fun of. I mean, he's clearly a responsible adult and accountable for what he does. And there's no hypocrisy in his manner, at least none that's developed yet. So she's sort of lost at the moment, although she did her best to destroy him last spring when he was fighting Hillary. I mean, she was playing the two of them off against each other and saying Barack was effeminate and weak and, yeah, and using all these gender cliches that one thought had gone out the window 30 years ago. And she just simply misread him. She described him as diffident, I mean, you know, Barack Obama is one of the most ambitious men in this country in the last 100 years. If he's anything but diffident. But his manner is so, was calm and cool, and he didn't rise to insults like hers. So she said he was diffident. In other words, she gets things wrong, as she got Al Gore wrong 8 years ago. She gets things wrong all the time because she only judges by the surface.
And without belaboring her, she being an example of this, but many other people too.
Sure.
You say that snark is the white man's last stand. It's snark's very heaven. And you also pair it to misogyny. So kind of the immersion of snark in the prejudices, the racial and gender prejudices.
Well, yeah, because one of the characteristics of snark is to appeal to some area, often of prejudice or distaste, that can simply needs to be evoked. So there was a lot of it directed at Obama during the campaign. Karl Rove's remark to a bunch of Republican insiders that you know what this guy is like. He's the guy who stands against the wall of the country club with his girlfriend with a cigarette and makes snide remarks about everyone who goes by. Well, at any literal level, that's complete nonsense, since whatever's wrong with Obama, he's certainly not snide. And there aren't many blacks even now in country clubs. So it was, in other words, it was a signal to people, to white people, I'm sorry to say, that you don't want to trust this guy. He's other. He's an uppity black who doesn't belong here in the inner circle. That's, you know, snarky appeal to prejudice disguised as a kind of joke. That there was a lot of that. Some of it, of course, was much cruder than that. And I had the feeling that the constant harping on Barack Obama's middle name, Hussein, and trying to associate him with a Muslim, that being used as a smear, which Republicans did, and there was a ton of it just anonymously on the Internet in blogs and so on, was a way of saying, you can't trust him, he's different, he's other, he's black, don't vote for him. At this point now, it's become less referential in that coded way and more open and closer to a kind of white supremacist rant. There's a ton of it on the Internet. But there certainly was a lot of it during the campaign.
And finally, David Denby, in Snark, you talk about the contrast to snark. You raise the example of one of my heroes, Stephen Colbert, and his speech to the National Press Club. I can remember just being thrilled and inspired by his courage, his undaunted courage to say what he did in the presence of the man he was satirizing and in the presence of the press club, the press who he was also satirizing, and then really, really shocked, I have to say, by some of the commentators who I really do appreciate. On the Media is one of my favorite shows, and I can remember the host of On the Media absolutely pillaring Colbert for his lack of taste. And
yeah.
I thought, wow, they really don't get it.
No, they don't. I mean, a lot of snark is anonymous, and it's cowardly and evasive and hides behind handles and so on. And Colbert's whole manner in general, of course, is a pretty highly developed kind of irony in which he says one thing and means the other. In other words, in his normal television show, he puts on his Bill O'Reilly rubber face mask and pretends to be a conservative and bullies the guests in such a way that exposes what, for him, are the absurdity of those conservative positions. Okay, that's his standard operating mode. That's irony when you say one thing and mean exactly the opposite. That operates as a pretty high level of sophistication in mass entertainment like television. I can't think of anything like it that has operated that cleverly for so many people. Anyway, in the 2006 White House press corps dinner, he confronted Bush directly and said, "I'm one of your fans. I'm one of your true believers," and then ridiculed him to his face using this ironic mode where he pretended to be a Bush adherent and really was exposing Bush's lies. And that was a stunning moment in our public life, and it embarrassed a lot of the journalists who were there, because those are generally very genial and meaningless occasions, those press corps dinners where people may roast the president's trouble with speaking English, but to actually question his policies in that abrasive way in front of everyone took an enormous amount of guts. And I end the book with him, because what he did there was the opposite of snark. I mean, that he used aggressive irony. It drove snark from the room. It was almost Swiftian in its courage and its, you know, complexity. And a lot of the media commentators were shocked by it and that said that there wasn't much laughter, meaning that he bombed as a comic. Well, he may have bombed as a comic, but he triumphed as a citizen.
Right.
And the thing went up on YouTube, and within a few weeks it was, you know, very well known, and I think it was one of the great public events recently.
Well, David Denby, thanks so much for talking with us here. Your book is Snark. It's mean, it's personal, and it's ruining our conversation.
Thanks so much.
David Denby is a staff writer for The New Yorker. He's also the author of great books and a memoir, American Sucker, about his misadventures as an investor in the dot-com stock market bubble. Next up, we talk with Pier Massimo Forni about the civility solution. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. While in the first half of today's show, we heard David Denby decry the proliferation of rudeness in the media, PM Forney wants to give us ideas about how to deal with it in our everyday lives. Piero Massimo Forney is a professor of Renaissance Italian literature at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, Maryland. But he's best known for his previous book, Choosing Civility. That spelled out rules and examples for building caring relationships with others. Now he's turned his attention to what to do when people are rude. His book is The Civility Solution. Pier Massimo Forni, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you, Francesca. I'm delighted to be here.
Now, you're a professor of Italian literature at Johns Hopkins University, and you wrote a previous book on civility, Choosing Civility. Now you've written The Civility Solution, What to Do When People Are Rude. At the risk of being rude myself, why is a professor of literature writing books on civility?
That's something that I wonder myself sometimes. I was, for about 20, 25 years of my career, a straight literary scholar, writing books of academic nature on 14th century Italian literature that all of 14 people read around the world. And at a certain point, after this being very satisfying for me for a long time, about 10 years ago or so, it was not enough anymore. I discovered that I needed to devote myself to something that had a little bit of more direct relevance with everyday life. And one day I was teaching my Dante class, my Inferno class, to my students, and a thought occurred to me: I want my students to know everything that there is to know about Dante. But even if they did, and then they went out to be unkind to a little old lady on a bus, I would think that I had failed as a teacher. It was an odd thought, but it stayed with me, and it changed my life. After having dedicated my life to the world of aesthetics, of art, I was a professor of literature after all, I think that the world of ethical thinking was knocking at my door. And I found this wonderful realm of gracious goodness, that is civility, good manners, and politeness, as the natural avenue to give of myself to a cause, the cause of how we treat one another in everyday life, and to obey, to heed that call to ethics that I had felt perhaps as a factor, as an element of my middle age crisis.
So basically you're saying that you You're setting your academic concerns aside for a moment and really trying to bring things into the realm of the real world.
Now that I look back at those years, I think that I can discern that after having devoted most of my life to a search for the beautiful, I felt the need of pursuing goodness. And I said to myself, perhaps this happens to most of us. In the first part of our lives, we pursue beauty. In the second part of our lives, we pursue goodness. And my pursuit of goodness came in the form of falling in love. Falling in love with this form of gracious goodness that we call civility and good manners. And I thought that they were very underutilized resources in society that were, I think, belittled very often, were considered trivial. And because very often one makes, puts them together with etiquette and thinks that they are about which fork to choose for the salad. And instead, they are about how we treat one another in everyday life and what's more important than that. So civility, good manners, and politeness are not trivial because they do the everyday busy work of goodness.
Something like the Golden Rule.
Indeed, indeed. And I mentioned the Golden Rule in my first book, Choosing Civility. That's certainly an important point of departure.
Now, tell us first, where does rudeness come from?
Rudeness has several causes. One of them is lack of restraint. And as a society, we have been very good at teaching our children self-esteem, but we have not been very good at teaching them self-restraint. Now, self-esteem is a good thing. It's a sort of an immune system for the soul. It keeps us sane. But when we need self-esteem, but when we feed our children oversized portions of self-esteem, we create children that are self-absorbed, who believe that the world revolves around them and makes them very often unable to be considerate and kind because they are so self-involved. In essence, they are trapped in a cage of narcissism that we have built for them.
In fact, you say that in a study, a 2006 study, two-thirds of college students scored above average on the narcissistic personality test.
That's right. And also the studies that are coming out from psychologists and sociologists tell us the new generation simply cares very little about the opinion that others have of them. When we compare the scores in concern about the opinion of others that we had in the 1950s or 60s, for instance, with the scores that we have now, we see that the children today, the youngsters of today, are simply indifferent to how they are perceived by society at large. And this is very scary.
Can that be a good thing as well as a bad thing? And is there a way to kind of, you know, is there a way to balance that? Is there a way to choose the good?
Yes, balance indeed should be our objective. And that's what I say when I often say when I talk to educators and parents that we shouldn't forget the importance of self-respect, injecting a sense of self-worth in the new generations, but it should be done in a balanced way. It should be there, but it should at the same time be aided, be completed with a training in healthy restraint, in acquiring the notion that just because you can do something, that doesn't mean that you should. And that's really the fundamental principle of ethical agency. But the wonderful thing about good manners is that it is when we learn good manners in our family at the dinner table, we learn not only rules of manners, but we learn rules of ethical behavior. When mama, let's say that mama tells little Timmy, you know, you should really chew with your mouth closed. But why, Mama, why should I do that? Well, let me tell you, it just appears that human beings don't seem to enjoy looking at half-chewed food in the mouths of others, or worse to that effect. Now, look at that response from mother. Mother has, yes, given little Timmy a simple rule of table manners, but has also given him the number one rule, the rule, the principle upon which all ethical systems have been based, the fact that our actions have consequences for others, and we should care about that.
You know, I think you're making a very important distinction here, because on the one hand, one can point to also many, many examples where people have not followed the rules for very good reasons. But those were ones, you know, that were the official rules that were geared towards protecting official power. And I think a lot of people conflate
Absolutely.
Ignoring those rules with the rules of civility.
Yes, civility and good manners are tools, and the tools are only as good as the use that we make of them. Is a car good or bad? Well, you can use a car to take a pregnant woman to the hospital and save the life of the woman and the child. Or you can use the same car to push someone else off the road in order to do harm to that person. And if you can use good manners and politeness to discriminate against people, to snub people, to exclude them from power and so on and so forth. But then, I would argue, you have the appearance of good manners, but not the substance.
Hmm. Now, you have in your book, The Civility Solution, you have 8 rules for a civil life. And I found it very interesting that the very first one on your list was slow down first. Why?
Yes. One of the reasons, we were talking a few minutes ago about the reason of rudeness, how rudeness comes into being, and we have touched upon one of them. Certainly another cause of rudeness is lack of time. And as we are very much task-oriented, and as we rush in what often is a mad rush for the attainment of our professional goals, we don't think that we have the luxury to slow down for the sole purpose of being kind to others. There is no way that we can escape this fact. In order to be kind and considerate, we need to take the time to be kind and considerate. Very often it's not an enormous amount of time, but very often we are not willing to do that only for just for a short amount of time, save time to pay attention to others, to validate them, to congratulate them on an achievement, to invite them for a coffee or a lunch. We are just so invested in our professional goals that we say simply, I don't have the time. What I really mean is I'm not willing to make the time.
And you also, interestingly, you say that injustice, a sense of injustice, is also part of rudeness, and you have some sympathy toward that.
Yes, I understand that very well. The perception of having been treated unfairly by a boss, by a relative, by society at large, is a cause of hostile behavior, and sometimes very disruptive, and sometimes tragically criminal behavior. And I think I understand better those transgressions that are caused by that than those that are caused by greed for accomplishment and the making of extra money. We know that people who perceive that their boss is being unfair to them are much more likely to develop cardiovascular disease than people in the general population. So injustice, lack of fairness, being at the receiving end of these, whether they are real or perceived, are very toxic. And they are very bad for our system, for our immune system in particular. They affect us in both psychological and very physical ways. And so one of the reasons that we have an obligation to be civil people is that we have an obligation to be fair people, especially to those who are in our charge in any way, such as people who work for us, whom we supervise, and whom we should treat in a human way, in a fair way, in a way that is consistent with not only a sense of justice, but a sense of empathy.
And we're speaking with Pier Massimo Forni. He is a professor of Italian literature at Johns Hopkins University, and he's written two books now on civility. This latest is The Civility Solution, What to Do When People Are Rude. Now, one of those things that you talk about to do when people are rude is you can disagree graciously, but you should refrain from arguing.
I always remember something that the great Dale Carnegie said. No matter what you are discussing, whatever the issue at hand is, never, ever, ever argue. Because if you lose, you lose. And if you win, you lose.
But that doesn't mean just remaining silent, does it?
No, indeed. What Carnegie meant was that you should discuss, you should debate, but you shouldn't take the debate and the discussion to a point where you, the two interlocutors, are so altered by anger, rage, frustration, and the desire and the attempt to prevail upon the other, that the real issues become buried, becomes lost, and the argument becomes about the argument itself, about winning, and without any other consideration.
Now, I have noticed that when I get into arguments with people, often I find myself telling them things, not asking them. And just the other day, I had an argument with my mother, and she said, don't make assumptions. And I was really thinking about that because I think human beings are kind of hardwired to make assumptions, but that's not really the best way to have a discussion.
No, it's not the best way. I mean, it's something, it's an instinct that was very useful for our survival, the survival of our ancestors. When they saw something move in the savannah, they made the assumption that it could be a wild animal. And so they prepared to flee, and we are still hardwired in the same way. And we have to categorize, we have to simplify reality, and very often we have to stereotype, inevitably, whether we like it or not. But one of the things that we learn when we try to become more civil, more considerate, and kinder, not to make assumptions or making them as little as possible, and instead of telling, asking the person, instead of saying, it's just about you to do that because you're always the kind of person that, saying instead, let me understand, explain to me what was your reasoning that brought you to do that, because it's difficult for me to understand, but I do want to see this from your point of view. So asking instead of telling is a very good tool of relational competence.
You just mentioned reality there, how we tend to simplify it. You almost take a Buddhist approach. You say that we need to accept reality. Part of this is accepting the fact that people are going to be rude to us. How can we deal with our initial reactions when people are rude to us?
The first thing is to try to depersonalize the slight as much as you can. Think that, for instance, if somebody is cutting you off on the beltway and you honk and then the other person responds with a show of finger puppetry, that is not against you personally. If you had been home with a cold today and someone else were in your position, he or she would be at the receiving end of that infamous digit. So depersonalize it. It's very often it's not about you. You happen to be in the line of fire. And so you can visualize the slight as a package that comes to you. But then you take it, but you return it unopened because it's not really for you. It's not about you, but it's about the state of mind of the person who sent the package of the rude act to you. So you return it. And sometimes this act of visualization helps. So depersonalizing, visualizing this light as not belonging to you, and remaining calm and collected because you have acquired the very healthy habit of not fighting reality.
Well, Piero Massimo Forni, in your book, The Civility Solution, you know, I found it very helpful, this formulation that you made of accepting reality not as a way to lie down passively in front of it, but in order to respond more effectively to it. So let's say now you've accepted that somebody has been rude to you. How do you decide whether or not to take up the issue with them?
You want to, first of all, decide whether this is the best moment to do that. Maybe you are in the company of others and it's not appropriate that they be involved in this, because it may not be appropriate that for others to listen. It's something that you want to discuss with that person. And so you have to make this decision. Maybe you decide that this is something, a battle that you don't want to fight. We cannot fight all battles. I would make a difference between a slide that comes from a stranger, somebody in a train station whom you're never going to see ever again, and it's a matter of a moment, and a slide that comes with a person who is part of your life, a friend of the family, a spouse. In this latter case, I think it's very important to speak up. It's very important to be assertive and explain to the other person what their behavior has done to you. Why? Because if you don't say anything and you repress your reaction, the other person will do it again tomorrow. And you repress again in order not to rock the boat, and the other person will do it again. And someday you're going to explode. And then the other person will say, but you never told me you felt that way. How was I supposed to know? And now you're doubly at fault. You're at fault because you never said anything and because you exploded. We teach others how to treat us by how much we are willing to endure from them.
You know, I find what you're saying very familiar. And I think that, speaking as a woman, you know, often we don't really feel that we have the right to say things, but then we're human beings, and when it comes out, we can really explode with them.
That's right.
I wonder if you could also address this power differential that exists sometimes between people. I just spoke of it in terms of women and men, but you also talk a lot about bullying at work. And, you know, bosses are not, of course, the only people who can be rude to you. You could have coworkers who are. But when it is a boss, how do you deal with a power differential in asserting your right not to be bullied?
The relationship with the boss continues to be a very, very delicate area of everyday life. A lot of the complaints about rudeness that I receive from readers who email me are about the workplace, about their relationships with their coworkers and their relationship with their bosses. And very often the complaint about the bosses is about lack of communication. Sometimes the boss is dismissive of one particular employee and is not acknowledging his or her merit, giving credit where the credit is due. And, of course, this is very frustrating because the employee at the receiving end of these dismissive or rude or unjust, unfair behaviors from the boss does not know whether he or she has the luxury to respond because they are afraid of retaliation. So it is an area of human behavior that is really fraught with uncertainty, with anxiety, with depression. And the rule of thumb is that you have certainly to proceed with cautiousness, but if at all possible, explain again to your boss what his or her behavior does to you. You don't have to be attacking. You don't have to be unkind. But you can certainly say, yesterday, again, you passed me over for a project of high visibility. I feel that this has happened several times. When you do this, it makes me feel that you don't value, you don't think that my contribution is valuable. Would you please consider this for the future? And that's the typical healthy way of presenting your doubts and your displeasure in a civil way. You state the problem, inform what the problem behavior does to you, and request a change is the SIR sequence of which I speak in the civility solution. You state the problem, you inform what the problem does to you, and then you ask for the behavior to change.
That's right. You know, I want to ask you for your advice on another rudeness issue. You have many examples in your book, Pier Massimo Forni. Your book is The Civility Solution, What to Do When People Are Rude. But I didn't find one that I'm concerned with, and I'm really at a loss of how to deal with. May I ask you?
Sure.
Well, I have an issue where someone very close to me, a younger person, and his wife, who I love very dearly, tend not to return my phone calls. You know, if I'm planning on visiting them and I let them know when I'd like to come down and I'd like to know when would be good for them, I don't hear back. And when I have tried to bring this up with them, they get rather in a huff, saying, you know, kind of with the attitude is, what's wrong with you? Why do you expect us to return your phone calls?
Yes.
You know, it's really up to us whether we're going to do that or not. What would you suggest?
My suggestion is to respond in the following way. I certainly understand that this is your rule of engagement. But I'm asking you in the name of our friendship and the name of the love that I have for the two of you that you consider also my own rule of engagement. When you do not respond my telephone calls, I feel that you may not be interested in my being part of your life. And, of course, that is painful to me. I cannot help that being the case. That's how I am. That's how I was raised. And I feel that I'm intruding by calling, and I feel discouraged. So now that you know what it feels from my side when you don't call back, it's up to you whether you want to do something about that.
Well, that's a very, very lovely advice. Thank you so much.
You're most welcome.
And thank you also, Pier Massimo Forni, for, and on your book, I should tell our listeners that your name is P.M. Forni. Your book is The Civility Solution. It was a very useful book, short, pithy, and promoting of the good and beautiful in that way.
Thank you very much, Francesca, for having invited me, and I hope that our paths will cross again.
P.M. Forni's previous book about civility is called Choosing Civility and was published in 2002. Go to writersvoice.net to hear P.M. Forni's advice on what to do when someone else suddenly pulls into the parking space you've been waiting so patiently for. It's an excerpt from today's interview that didn't make it into the show. And check out our links and more information about today's guests. That's at www.writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Be sure to visit us at writersvoice.net to find out who's coming on next week, listen to archive shows, and leave your comments and suggestions. That's www.writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.